Well, hi, everybody. This is the Top Practices Mindset Call for October 24th, 2016. And I just want to welcome everybody on the call. Dave Fries is with me, as he has been all year. Dave, it's great to have you on the call today as well.
Thank you, Rem. Pleased to be here.
Now, I'm anticipating there's going to be a lot of activity, a lot of folks that are live on this. This is a very big topic. It's a very current topic. It's on people's minds a lot. And so, if you're live, we'll give you a chance at the end to bring up some questions if you've got them. Dave, as I said to you just before we went live, this we may make it through this agenda today. We might not. In which case, we'll extend it on to next month if we have to. So let's just jump right into it. The topic today is the misunderstanding and the subsequent challenges that are faced by those of us that are in the workforce today. And those are primarily the generations that are known as the baby boomers, the Generation X, the Gen Xers, and the younger, very large group that is joining the workforce in record numbers, the millennials, as they're referred to, or Gen Y, or the millennials. So, Dave, you know, I brought this up because I was actually talking to my daughter Iris about this, and it was fascinating. We really had a wonderful, really great conversation about it, mainly the fact that I hear all the time, I hear people that are frustrated, doctors that are, you know, either they're mostly boomers, some Gen Xers, certainly, that say, they're very frustrated with the people that they work with, the younger people that they work with, and then they say, quote, well, they're millennials, so what do you expect? And here's the thing. There's that song, you know, about millennials and all this other, there's an awful lot of press about it, and it's so unhelpful. It is wrong on so many levels. You can never judge a individual, a person, by the group that they belong to. It's not just, I mean, I suppose there are some groups, but certainly not an age-related generational group. Maybe you can discern things from people, from affiliations that they choose, but certainly not just because somebody was born between a certain bracket of years or many other things that would be obviously not okay. It's just plain wrong. On top of that, it's really unhelpful if you're trying to solve an issue you're having by just saying, oh, well, obviously you'd be that way because, you know, you're this age group. I mean, you could even say, well, you're a boomer, so what else are you going to do? I mean, if this goes back and forth both ways, I just hear it more from my boomer Gen X doctors than I do from millennials because, you know, the doctors are at that level where they're the equity, it's because of their age. You can't judge anybody this way. And Dave, so, you know, I want to give you a chance to speak about that before I kind of get into, we're going to kind of set some things up here and try to give you a real, actual actionable things that you can do, which you may or may not like, but you can do to try to solve these problems. So Dave, what are your thoughts about all this? You're hearing this too, right?
I am, and I hear it in law practices and in medical and dental practices. But of course, it's an overgeneralization, but it's also something that you can't afford to ignore. And here's what I mean by that. There are real differences because this group that we've labeled millennials, they work in a different way. They use technology in a different way. And the medium is, as McLuhan said, the message. They get used to blurring the line between work and personal life. So what they get blamed for is looking at personal emails or taking a personal call during the day because they're so attached to their devices. What they don't get credit for is that they take work emails and do all kinds of work after hours because they don't make some of those same distinctions we do. So, of course, all of these things that we're talking about are growth over generalizations because in any age group or population group, there's a whole spectrum of behaviors. But there are some real things here because of how they've grown up with technology and how they were raised and treated in a world very different than, you know, the equity holder generation right now. It just seems like the boomer generation wants to have all the frustration without giving any of the credit. And once they have all the frustration without taking responsibility for really bringing millennials in and taking maximum advantage of how to lead them and work with them and engage with them in teams and in networks that they love working in.
That's well said. That's really well said. And I think that kind of frames this because there is an incumbency on the part of us boomers and Gen Xers to embrace this. First of all, you have no other choice. You cannot sit this out. There's 80 million millennials. That's the largest generation in the history of the human race. They have surpassed the boomers. You can't sit this one out if you're planning on working in the next 10, 15 years.
You can't sit it out either as the workforce or as the buying customer.
So you've got to look at this and understand this. Exactly. And now, of course, but I want to be really clear so that we don't just freak out all the boomers right in the beginning, and that is there is great and many things that millennials can learn as well. So this is about understanding back and forth between, in this case today, we're talking about the generations. Here's a quote I just read, by the way, about the current generation of young people. And here's the quote. These children now love luxury. They have bad manners, contempt for authority. They show disrespect for their elders. They love the chatter in place of exercise. They're now tyrants, not the servants of their households. They no longer rise when elders enter the room. They contradict their parents. They chatter before company. They gobble up dainties at the table, cross their legs, and tyrannize their teachers. So I lied. That is actually attributed to Socrates about 450 BC. You know, I can remember, Dave, do you remember? I looked everywhere online for this. Lucille Ball gave a speech on the Lucy Show where she quoted that. And she said that about the boomers, by the way, this the boomer ones, the 60s, about how bad they were. And then she said, actually, this is Socrates. And so, and they actually say this might or might not actually be Socrates. That said it. But anyway, this is a perennial issue, perennial millennials. I mean, there are answers here if you have some understanding. Make some sense? So let's do this, Dave. Let's just quickly review who's who. You know, I and by the way, when you go on and you start looking up generations, there's agreement and disagreement. But real quickly, there's the Depression era people that were born from 1912 to 1921, and there are very few of those folks that are left now. Those were my grandparents. The World War II generation, the people in this, I want to read this, people in this cohort, they were born from 1922 to 1927. They shared in a common goal of defeating the Axis powers. There was an accepted sense of deferment among this group, contrasted with the emphasis on me in more recent cohorts. They're the group we call the greatest generation. They're very much about the greater good and bigger things than them. And we're losing them now at about, I think it's about 400 World War II vets a day pass away. And I've got one of them in my life still. I've got actually both Diane's parents who are World War II folks are in that cohort. And then there's the post-war cohort. But Dave, these are the people that raised you and me, I think. Born 1928 to 1945, would that be your parents?
Yeah, mine are the last year of that. They were born in 46, actually.
Yeah, mine were born in like 36 and thereabouts. So, and now this group, you know, things were good. They had the Cold War threat and all this kind of stuff. They raised you and me, Dave, and they value security, comfort, familiar, known activities and environments. They are not helicopter parents. They were not helicopter parents. That did not exist. I mean, basically, it's like, just don't get killed. That was pretty much what they had no idea where we were, what we did, right? We were on our own, pretty much.
That was totally my experience.
Yeah, that's right. It was just like, you know, just get, if it's dark, it's like you probably ought to be heading home now. There was no connection like that at all, and it wasn't seemed unusual. Okay, then there's the baby boomers. Now, here's the thing. The thing I read, which I'm going to bring up real quickly, is I like this, is they say there's boomers one, or the baby boomers. There's boomers one and boomers two. So boomers one, they're defining as born from 1946 to 1954. That's about 45 million or so, depending. It's complicated. But for a long time, the baby boomers were defined as those people born between 45 and 64, which would make a gigantic generation, about 71 million. And it encompassed people who were really farther apart in age. It didn't make any sense to have those people that were born in 1964 be compared in a group with those born in 46. I mean, they were completely different life experiences. And basically, boomer ones, they're bounded by the Kennedy and the Martin Luther King assassinations, the Civil Rights Movement, and the Vietnam War. Boomer ones were in or protested the war. Boomer twos, or they call them the Jones generation, missed the whole thing, which is you and me, Dave. I mean, I remember seeing the soldiers in Life magazine that were killed, but the war was over, and I can remember being relieved. Boomer ones had good economic opportunities and were largely very optimistic about the potential for America and their own lives, the Vietnam War notwithstanding. Then you get to boomer two. That's who a lot of us are, who are currently involved and raised, by the way, millennials. And we were born 1955 to 1965. There's 30 million or more of us. We're post-Watergate, so we don't trust anybody or believe anything. We have a sense of I'm out for me and narcissism and focus on self-help, skepticism over media and institutions. You know, the boomers had Vietnam. We had the two boomers had AIDS as our kind of our rites of passage. And here's the thing. The youngest members of the baby two generation, boomer two, did in fact not have the benefits of the boomer one class. We were, you know, housing, opportunities, jobs were taken by that group. And even more so, they call it the Generations Jones because we're kind of a large, anonymous generation. We're just sort of the type that, like, keeping up with the Joneses, we're competitive. And then there's the slang word of jonesing, or meaning a yearning or a craving. And it said that we were given huge expectations as children in the 60s and then confronted with a very different reality as we came of age during a long period of mass unemployment and deindustrialization. And so we lost our jobs. We had problems. And this was a tough time for those of us that are boomers now. Have been through massive upheavals and been involved in it. Real quickly, Generation X came next. They're 1966 to 1976 or thereabouts. It's smaller than the other generations, and consequently, they don't quite identify as a group as much. They kind of got assimilated by Boomer twos, and so. But these are the latchkey kids. Divorce, daycare, all of this stuff is what happened. And so, you know, they're well educated, they're doing fine. They have education, maturity. They're very cautious, and they're very careful about trying to avoid broken homes or the things that kind of define them. And then last but not least, we're talking about the Generation Y, the Echo Boomers and Millennials. So this largest cohort, it's about 80 million. It's the biggest ever. By the way, Dave, it's growing because we're getting an influx, a migration of people of this age. So it's really not 80 now, but they think by in a few years it'll be up to 80 million people because we're bringing a lot of people from around the world are migrating here that are this age. So they're big because there was a big generation of parents, the last of the boomers and the boomer twos. Millennials are known as incredibly sophisticated. Technology-wise, they're more racially and ethnically diverse. They're much more segmented as an audience because of the internet. They're less brand loyal. They're very flexible, and they change with fashion and style because if it's communicated in such a way. One of the biggest things that happened to them and influenced them in a way is 9/11, and the aftermath of all that has been their entire lives for most of them, or they were young when it happened. Most millennials were raised in dual income or single parent families, and they've been involved in like family purchases. They're really engaged, very, very more connected. Millennials often will have a credit card that has been co-signed by a parent. They're close to their older generation. They're close to their parents, and they see this as natural. Whereas we weren't nearly, I mean, not that we're not close to our parents, but it was a very different relationship. So here's a little bit more, and then Dave, I'm going to give you a chance to jump in before we talk about what do you do about all this. Unlike the Gen Xers and the baby boomers, millennials have developed work characteristics and tendencies from having doting parents, very structured lives, and contact with diverse groups of people. They're used to working in teams, and they want to make friends with people at work. This is important. It'll come up later. Millennial employees work well with a diverse coworker population. Very, very well. Millennials, by the way, have a can-do attitude about tasks at work, and they look for feedback about how they are doing frequently, even daily. And we'll talk more about what that means. Millennials want a variety of tasks, and they expect that they'll accomplish every one of them. They are the most positive and confident generation since the greatest generation in World War II. Millennials are ready to take on the world. They seek leadership. They seek structure from their older and managerial coworkers. But they also expect that you're going to draw out and respect their ideas. That's a big point. They assume, rightly so, that you'll want to know and respect their ideas. Millennials seek a challenge, and they don't want to experience boredom. I mean, they are used to balancing many activities, teams, friends, philanthropic activities. They like flexibility in scheduling, and they like a life away from work. For millennials, work is often seen as what they do between their weekends. That's a very different approach to things than the boomers had. And millennials want to see where their career is going, and they want to know exactly what they need to do to get there. Millennials await their next challenge, I mean, and there better be a challenge for them. They're the most connected generation in history, and they'll network themselves right out of their current workplace if their needs aren't being met. And they're connected all over the world, in ways that boomers just haven't actually been able to even access, because we don't know about a lot of that stuff, and we're interested in that. So that kind of lays them all out. Dave, any thoughts about that?
Yes, I liked your mention that millennials are fashion conscious. So this doesn't necessarily mean, by the way, that they are spending the most on fashion that we've ever seen spent. And for those of us who aren't millennials, it may look like large chunks of the millennial world. Fashion means a boots with rolled up skinny jeans and a plaid shirt. But here's the thing about fashion. We should always be looking for recurring themes that may be affecting the broader population, especially sort of like harkening back to different times. And fashion is a very early predictor of that. And there are a lot of writers on the millennial generation that say that they do pay close attention to this. So these little changes in fashion may not be visible to us because we're not thinking about it or looking at it in the same way. But become more attuned to it. It will pay dividends in your professional practice if you begin to watch fashion and understand that this group is used to more rapid change and interested in more rapid change and interested in fashion even when it's a discrete change. And so that's sort of a positive aspect of the millennial generation that means that if we're going to be selling to them as well as employing them, that we should become more attuned to fashion. I like that you were talking about that when I first got your notes on what we'd be talking about, Rem. And I've read a number of studies where fashion is being used more and more successfully by businesses, and that tech businesses and a number of businesses that technically and historically would look like they're not related in fashion to fashion in any way are paying very close attention to fashion as a quick early canary in the mine and as a predictor of what's coming next in broader trends. Also really liked this idea when you were describing them of them being very networked with one another. That's kind of my experience with the millennial folks that we have employed. And then, of course, my own kids. They are way more networked. When Josh moved to the West Coast, he wasn't even concerned about having a place to stay because here he is. He's an East Coast kid, pretty well traveled, but hadn't spent a whole lot of time in California. And he probably had his choice of 10 or 15 people that he could stay with until he found an apartment. And he weirdly did not want to shop for it online. He wanted to be there and to see it. And all of his network contacts were the ones that lined up all these apartments he could go and see beforehand. Again, offers a really unique opportunity in both managing millennials and dealing with millennials as a customer or a patient or a client. And there's a great book by Stanley McChrystal called Team of Teams, which just discusses in a military context how important it is for quickly diffusing information to use a kind of network offense, a network type of environment, and also how networks bring together the view of all these different people with data coming from different aspects of the problem, and it kind of pools their brains. And so this makes millennials very, 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 very important to us when we are leading them as part of teams, because they can, it's a very much more rapidly changing work environment than it ever was before. And their highly networked structure and way of looking at the world can be helpful to us. And again, it can be helpful to us in predicting who's going to what, when, and who's going to need different kind of approach than traditional medicine offers. For example, you know, there may be things that you want to change in your podiatry practice. Like, you know, obviously in most podiatric practices, millennials are not the patients yet, but they are becoming the patients. And even my kids have had needed certain kinds of procedures. And, you know, there are reasons why millennials become patients sooner rather than later. And having them work for us is going to pose unique challenges, but unique opportunities to be ahead of the curve in anticipating what the marketplace wants, whether they're millennials or not. So what looks like it's all hard on us and that we have to adapt is really an opportunity for us to learn and grow ourselves and to get advanced knowledge of what's happening in the marketplace, because these network millennials are not just networked and talking about their own needs, but everybody else's needs as well.
Yeah, they're well said. They're really clued in. A couple more things, then I want to get to the, well, what do we do about it stuff. There's a lot of anecdotes now. I mean, there's, by the way, I'm going to be putting a list of these notes that Dave and I have today are going to go into the website. I don't generally do that, but I'm going to stick them in here because there's a lot here. And then a lot of directions to a lot of different articles if you want to read yourself. But Stephanie Nora White and Tom Tischhauser, or however you say his name, wrote a book. These folks, that's not the book. I'll tell you about the book in a minute. These were folks that were contributing on a pretty cool website. So they say, although labeled as entitled, self-absorbed, and sheltered, millennials are more than 80 million strong. They outnumber even the boomers. And these anecdotes about them have become stereotypes. Like, they show up, and these are folks that are graduating from college roughly from 2003 to 2018. You know, they come to job interviews in flip-flops. They want to know right away about telecommuting policies and expecting quick and painless ascensions up the corporate ladder. These are the kinds of stereotypes that are showing up. And these kinds of things, there's a lot of this out there. And it's like, for instance, there was a study done by York College of Pennsylvania Center for Professional Excellence. One-third of professors and HR professionals cited declining professional behavior by students. This included failing to project a professional image, dress appropriately for work, use social media appropriately. So the point here is there's no disputing that millennial generation is regarded as different and generally not in a good way, at least according to, you know, the boomers, the last big tidal wave. MTV, interestingly enough, on their No Collar Worker survey found that when you ask boomers and millennials how their companies can inspire great work, a standard boomer response was, give me my objectives and get out of the way. While a typical millennial sought flexibility, respect, and snacks, which I thought was funny, but actually is not completely out of keeping with what we're going to get to here, which is all of these things create tensions. I mean, and now the interesting thing is they're the largest group in American history. They're also the most studied. They have really done an enormous amount of work looking into, you know, what motivates these younger workers, this generation. So here's the Rem and Dave guide to understanding each other and working with each other, having said all of that. Number one, stop talking about how entitled they all are. And they can hear us, by the way, whenever we talk about it. They're on this call today. They'll be listening to this call, and I hope that they are. Because it's not remotely accurate at all. I mean, this whole, well, it's because you all got a trophy for participating. And by the way, Dave, who do you think came up with the idea for everybody getting a trophy, right? We did. Their parents did. I mean, we're the ones that, you know, that came up with that concept. So stop talking about the trophies, like, now. Just get over that and move on past this stereotypical stuff. See, they've been listening to us as we raised them, and then, Dave, they thought we meant what we said, and that's the funny part. This is the book that I wanted to recommend. It's called You Raised Us, Now Deal With Us by Stiller Reiklen, R-I-K-L-E-E-N. Pretty interesting book. And she says, and then Dave, I want to give you a chance to jump in here. Well, actually, I want to get down to the teaching points, and I'm going to toss it over to you. She goes, I realized at a point that there was a huge disconnect between the qualities we try to instill in our children when we're raising them and how they play out in the workplace. And she says, the purpose of writing her book was to parse through why the generations that raise them is having such difficulties adjusting to their behaviors at work. And again, the one stereotype is that millennials feel entitled. Now, here's what I want you to think about. We're confusing the word entitlement with what self-confidence and self-respect look like in young people. So it's off-putting to an older person to see young people coming into the workplace so self-confident. And she says, I don't think other generations were raised to be focused on being self-confident the way millennials were. The whole parenting notion that you're special and making our children feel secure in the world has created a very self-confident group of people that see the world, by the way, extremely positively. The most positive generation since the World War II generation. And Dave, I am going to stop right there. Before we move on. So thoughts about that particular issue?
Yeah, so one thing, you know, that you raised here is this idea that we raised our kids to be this way. So obviously there are large numbers of us who did not. So my kids were not raised in that way. And they come back and report to me, not just, I think, to curry favor, that they sometimes feel horror at what they're seeing and hearing, too. But that's for the same reason, that I think they're mistaking the positive trait of optimism and self-confidence for a sense of entitlement. But let me say this. Optimism, according to General Colin Powell, is the ultimate force multiplier. And most psychologists and psychiatrists I've talked with that do pre-hire assessment work agree that hiring for optimism is ultimately a huge force multiplier and will serve you well, because life is not always the way we think it's going to be. And optimism gets people to act and to get up and dust themselves off and to say, well, that's not because of me, and here's what I'm going to do about it. The problem is that self-confidence can easily be mistaken for arrogance, and it can easily transition over into arrogance. So the very thing, the optimism that makes them strong, also carries with it the danger of self-confidence tilting over into arrogance. So we often hear, and I've seen it myself in my own practice when millennials come in, oh, I know a better way to do that. I know a better way to do that. Well, rather than be frustrated by it, because that didn't do anything for me, is that in the interviewing process, I would say to people, look, I know you're going to come in, and you're going to have great ideas. And we have a process to gather them and to work through them, and we respect ideas. But you should know that we don't necessarily enact every great idea. And here's how we work. Give us 6 months where you work with our old antiquated systems that we've built, knowing that they might or might not need improvement and that you are going to have a place at the table improving them. But it is impossible, given how complex things are, for you to really see the whole picture until you give us 6 months with the old ones. And then at that point, like, write them all down. keep them, get them ready for us. At that point, we're going to begin the process of incorporating you into rebuilding and fixing and improving these standard operating procedures. But we make a social contract with them at the start that is not unreasonable. We'll even ask them that. Is that unreasonable for us to ask that? And some people will say, no, but if I spot things earlier, you don't want me to tell you? And I say, well, you can tell us, but really, what's going to often happen is we're going to say, well, we know this thing that you don't know yet. And if you give us 6 months, you're going to know all the stuff we know because you're smart, you're quick, and you're going to pay attention to this. So we form a social contract with them, which they agree is reasonable. And then it doesn't seem draconian for us to ask them to wait the 6 months. And it doesn't seem arrogant to us because, like, I had a buddy that came to me and said, I hired this guy you told me to hire. And he came to the office of the chief operating officer of the company like day three and started making suggestions. Now, I guarantee you that kid that they hired was a good kid. And I guarantee you he probably had good ideas. But how could he be taken seriously? You know, he'd only been there 3 days. He could not possibly have known. But they didn't make a social contract with him. And he was trying to be helpful and they thought he was arrogant. So take advantage of the fact that they want to be super helpful and they're going to pay attention and they want to be on the team, but also take advantage of the fact that they're smart enough to know that they should work at a place and really get to know and understand its mission before they can really effectively decide to change it for the better. So
no, I think that's great.
That's how
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dave. Yeah.
That's how we do it. We make the contract up front. Otherwise,
see, and that's where we're coming. It really does come down to anticipating. You can anticipate much of these issues by knowing a lot more about yourself and about knowing about them. And that whole concept right there of having an agreement up front, an understanding, is going to really get into like the second big point after stop rattling on about how entitled they are. That's not what actually is going on. They don't have the what we think of as entitlement is different. It's a form of self-confidence and an optimism, and it's also and it's partially too, I think, inexperience. So here's the question that was asked of the woman that wrote that book. So did we make a mistake as parents? Did we screw up and raise our kids to be overconfident or, you know, appear other than they are? And she says, I think we probably did not spend enough time focusing on how important it is to temper self-confidence with modesty when you're interacting with other adults at work. Because they have that's an interesting thing that we'll come up with. Millennials are very confused and somewhat disappointed by how we have always been outside of work and how we actually behave at work. And that's where I think this really gets down to it. So the teaching point for boomers and Gen Xers, millennials aren't being intentionally rude or disrespectful when they expect to be heard and believe they have a real contribution to make. They're trying to contribute. They're trying to help. So change the way you see their motivation and be open to their ideas with coaching them, communicating with them, and establishing expectations with them. By the way, every once in a while, you just come up with a really rude person because, I mean, that could easily be the case. Don't just accept rudeness from people. I mean, rudeness is rudeness. But don't misunderstand, then think that you're seeing rudeness and arrogance. What you're actually seeing is something very different, a person that's trying to contribute and does not have the same belief that we do that you should shut up until maybe somebody even asks you. That's a very boomer thing to do. We'll talk about why in a minute. So for millennials now, be aware that your boomer and your Generation X team members, they grew up in very hierarchical time when they had to pay their dues. At least in our mind, we paid our dues. We put our time in, and we believe very strongly, hold very strong opinion, that we earned our positions. You know, in many ways, Dave, just by outlasting our even more hierarchical and seemingly even more unreasonable bosses. We think we're cool bosses. Why would anybody think I'm not a cool boss? Because you know, you should have met the person that I had to work from, and they're kind of, you know, they're like, you know, I don't need to hear about your horror stories. That's not life today, right? So, millennials, try to see if there's anything that you can do to help reassure your boomer and ex bosses that you do respect them. You do respect what they've been through and accomplished, and you truly do want to learn from them and believe that there is much that they can teach you, which, by the way, leads us to our second big point, which is number two, be prepared to provide constant coaching and feedback. This is big, folks. This is like really important. And so here's, millennials have spent a lifetime, their entire lives, getting regular, in some cases near instantaneous feedback. This is their world. Whether it's a lightning quick response to a text message or school tests that are computer graded and then posted to an internet grade book, which they're very used to, within an hour or two, this generation has been strongly conditioned to live, work, and play with near instantaneous feedback. And there's a stereotype out there that millennials just want to be told how great they are. Just, you know, how great am I? Tell me how great I am. But that's not what it is. In this case, they have a very strong desire for feedback in the workplace in order to understand how they're doing. And the good news is that feedback does need to be continual. We are going to have to accommodate that and understand that, and we have to lean in on this. But it doesn't have to be involved or formal. I mean, again, just a quick text or an email or a two-minute conversation can often do the trick. Remember this, millennials are very used to and are very comfortable with adults providing this in their lives. I mean, they aren't looking for a boss, by the way. They're not looking for a boss like we were. They're looking for a mentor, not necessarily a boss. They want a mentor because they've had parents and teachers and coaches giving them feedback constantly their entire lives. And suddenly now, here's the funny part, they get to work and it just stops. And this is kind of weird, especially for them, because here's the funny thing about us boomers. We are very resistant to giving feedback. Like for us, we would go with no news is good news. That's what a boomer thing. No news is good news. We don't particularly like getting feedback, and we aren't used to giving it. That is not how we were raised. But again, we were raised in a vacuum. I guess I'm doing okay. And by the way, we're truly really busy too. We feel like I don't have time to just go constantly. Now, here's what we would say: make you feel better about yourself and tell you how great you are. But that's not it. They're looking for data points, connections, mentoring. And remember this, no feedback for a millennial is negative feedback. It corresponds to negative feedback. For us, it's like it's good news. For them, it's negative feedback. And think about how you raised your own kids. Now they go to work and they wonder, how come you won't, what happened? You were like so involved and engaged and helpful. Now you get into work and boom, you suddenly don't even want to talk about stuff. That is confusing to them. Dave, does that make sense?
It does. And Rem, I added my notes when you and I were talking about this in prep to bring up something here. So one is you could feel resentful about this. It is the nature of the world that everybody gets more feedback. We just don't seem, for all of the reasons Rem's sort of sociologically saying, to need it. We kind of have a different default. But all of us are going to react to what I'm about to talk about the same way. There's this supposedly modern, sophisticated view of giving feedback that you say whenever you can, here's the thing you did well, here's the thing you did poorly, oh, by the way, you did this well. There's this good, bad, good process that people have been taught through the years. I personally never used it, at least not intentionally. I don't believe it works, and there's lots of scientific data to back me up. So if Rem and I have convinced you that finding ways to give feedback more regularly, more often, not just to make them feel good, because this is what they're looking for, and that is the environment in which they'll thrive, and you could be a catalyst to either make that happen or retard it or to lose them. So if you're going to give more feedback, do not fall victim to the good, bad, good model. Here is why. Psychologically, we so much more react to negative feedback or negative information. We are so much more motivated, as a general rule, to avoid loss that good, bad, good doesn't do it. We have to find better ways of complimenting when they do something good. And this is not just millennials. This is all humans. and asking them to dissect the things that weren't so good. For example, I might ask somebody, what were the factors that you considered? Why did you choose to do it that way, something that didn't work out? And they'll tell me, and then I'm going to say, okay, what else could we or should we have considered or done differently so that we got a different result? Yes, you're grappling with something that's bad, but nobody's trying to trick you into thinking that the bad thing didn't happen, and somebody is honoring you and giving you enough respect to figure out what you might do differently in the future to make it work out. So just be careful, and don't fall victim to the overly simplified notion that you've got to give millennials more feedback, and you're going to have negative things to say, so don't operate under the mistaken belief that the good, bad, good model is going to solve all that.
Okay, so here's some real action points that you can do to become a better coach and mentor to the millennial members of your team. And by the way, remember, millennials were raised to like the adults in their lives. They're much more inclined to like working with more senior people than we're appreciating, much more than we boomers were. You know, they're very integrated generationally and are comfortable with this. So here's how you do it. Number one, provide structure.
Can I hop in there for 1 second?
Yeah.
You remarked last night you saw a Facebook Live event I did with my son Alex, who's 23. Can you, and you saw a little bit of it, you were traveling, it was great. Can you imagine, Rem, your father or mine asking us to do something like that? And
never.
Or us being super comfortable doing it? And for Alex, that was the most natural thing in the world. It goes right to this point that you're making, which is that they're very comfortable having older people involved in their lives and giving them feedback. So let's just be careful about how we use that for good rather than for evil. So sorry to interrupt.
No, I mean, I could never in a million years. My father and I didn't talk about stuff like that and certainly didn't have the same interests. And it's fun to watch you and Alex because, Alex is very much driving, a lot of the experimentation you guys are truly collaborating, which I think is is really, really cool. Okay, so here's how to do this. Number one, provide structure. So here's the deal. You always should have reports that are given to you weekly or monthly with very specific due dates. You know, in the case of Peter Wishney, I always talk about the fact he gets all his numbers delivered to him on Friday. They're compiled by one individual and sent to him in a report. Every single person on there is responsible for their part of the numbers. Every member of your team, not just the millennial members, everyone should have to report in a very structured way, you should just have to do that. Now, jobs have regular hours. That's certain activities are scheduled every day. Meetings have agendas and minutes. By the way, here's the thing. You can have really clearly stated goals and working towards those goals and define those assignments and everything. How are we going to know whenever we're succeeding? So here's the thing I love about this is meetings and trainings are appreciated and even anticipated by this group. Getting together for your weekly staff meeting is an incredibly important way to help move things along with you and your entire staff, especially in this case, your millennials. And I'll tell you something, with millennial doctors who are now employees of the practice, I think that we boomers tend to think, again, no news is good news. They're okay. I'll get around to it. Because you just wouldn't want somebody to be connecting with you in that way. I think it's the biggest mistake that I see our doctors make. I think you should be having breakfast with this person once a week. I think you ought to be having a structured review and very clear expectations and everything being happening in a written way with these individuals at least once a month. And that should be, like you said, Dave, those expectations should be clear and very carefully discussed before they're even hired. I think otherwise, you just start going down the wrong paths. This is where I believe action plans. I am the number one fan of action plans that I know. And action plans, I believe, are working very well with me and my entire staff, but also my millennial staff members really kind of grab onto it and like it and utilize them as tools beyond what I've even asked them to do. I think that's a great structure that you can provide, and that provides an enormous amount of feedback. I mean, that, you know, where are we on track? Good job. Way to go. Thank you. And reviewing those on a weekly basis. I mean, again, they, millennials want to look up to you. They want to learn from you, and they want to receive daily feedback from you. But they also want to know, this is the interesting thing, Dave, they want in on the whole picture. I mean, they want to know the scoop. And so I think you have to plan to be teaching, coaching, reporting, checking, and be aware that when you do this, you're going to have to do this when you hire them. It, and it's what they deserve. I mean, the very best investment of your time, you know, in their success. And just encourage. I mean, they have a self-assured, can-do attitude, very positive, you know, personal self-image. I mean, they are ready to take on their world. The parent, your, their parents told them they can do it, and they can do it. So encourage this and work with it, structure it, and don't squash them or contain it, and don't do your natural runaway because, you know, I don't need all this feedback. Why do they need all this feedback? Look, it is a good way to run your company. It is a great way to communicate with this generation. Dave, thoughts on that before we move to the
Rem,
next one?
Think about how all of these things we're saying, which may sound onerous to practice owners, match precisely with the prerequisites in Jocko's book, or in turn, The Ship Around, about developing deep-level decentralized command,
right,
where people can make decisions on their own. So everything that you just said, all is a foundational prerequisite to building good leaders. They have to know more. We have to explain the strategy to them. They can't just be millennials and anybody that responds to leadership and to develop and who develops themselves as a leader at whatever level in your organization needs to know what's the mission and then what are the tactics that we're expecting to get from here to there and what is the plan so that if the plan doesn't go as expected, which it won't, that they then know what to do. So they know the standard operating procedure. They help to develop the standard operating procedure, but when it's no longer effective, they know when to depart from the standard operating procedure. So all of these things that we spend an enormous amount of time on early in the year and through the summer, which I think have been really helpful to people, these are the things that we're saying we want to do to effectively lead and manage millennials. They're the things we have to do to effectively lead and manage any organization. And while they feel hard to us, this generation is demanding them of us, which is fine, because it's what we should be doing anyway.
It's how we raised them. And now they get to work and they're like, but you guys, you used to be like so, you know, so involved. And now you don't even want to talk to me. And that we have to look in the mirror hard. On that one, are we providing the kind of feedback that we need to do? And again, that's right, Dave. It's what we should do. It's leader. It's everything that we talk about. It's the Peter Wishney, Tina Del Buono approach to good, positive communication. And yet, we aren't that great at it. And that's a skill we're going to need to get. All they want is to be coached and mentored, and not just have a boss. Let's move on to number three. See if we can get through this. But that's all we're going to accomplish today. We'll finish this on the next call and maybe have a little bit more on the next call as well on something else. But appreciate this one here. Millennials see work as a means to an end, but not the end. This is a big difference. So here's the deal. Millennials largely are children of boomers, and they have witnessed up close and personal the devastation of layoffs, underemployment, eroding pay and benefits for their parents. They've watched their parents go through the downsizing of America. I mean, millennials can be motivated to work very hard. They are. But they are far more likely to reject the 60-hour work weeks that their parents put in because, you know, their underlying value is, well, what's the point? That was never rewarded. I've never seen where that comes, where that takes you. That's a thing that's driving them. So they did a two-year study with PricewaterhouseCoopers, found that millennial workforce, they are looking for benefits that are more in line with that philosophy. They are willing to trade reduced pay for fewer work hours because, as I said before, work is you know, this is an overgeneralization, but work is what they do between their weekends. They really have very, again, scheduled and very robust lives outside of work. They don't see it in the same way that we do. And I think that's a pretty healthy outlook, in my opinion. I mean, you know, we work ourselves to the bone and wonder why we're so frustrated and depressed. I mean, millennials' their childhood and their social lives have strongly influenced their workplace expectations. So here's the deal. These are people who have grown up with their calendars chock full of play dates, sports teams, extracurricular activities. Almost 9 in 10 millennials want their workplaces to be social and fun. Social and fun. They like going to work. They want to have a good time at work because they see that as an extension of their lives, whereas, you know, we see it as it's work. There's a big difference there. So here's some, and Dave, before I get into the teaching points that can really help you, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think this is one of those things where their desire to have fun, you know, built into many aspects of their lives, and to have a more balanced life, we and stakeholders and equity holders in practices and existing businesses have often viewed as laziness, and you couldn't be more wrong about that. And probably when we look at it, their ideal of having a more fun workplace and a more balanced work-life balance is probably healthier, and there's a number of studies that show that that actually results in better decision-making and productivity in the long run because we do exhaust ourselves. So, of course, we don't like it because it's different and it makes us feel stupid for having wasted our lives working 60 to 80-hour work weeks when we probably shouldn't have. But they probably, as Rem says, have the healthier outlook.
Well, and we'll look at this on the next call, but because of their technological abilities, they look at this and they say, well, why wouldn't you just work smarter? Why wouldn't you be more efficient? We can get as much, if not more, work done in the same amount of time. It's just, you know, it would be a lot more efficient. They're much more interested in efficiencies, and whereas we tend to think in terms of hours instead of, like, objectives and goals. And,
yeah,
you know, if you're – right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when we get efficient, what do? We pack more stuff in then.
That's right. Instead of, go ahead and enjoy our life. That's right. That's perfectly said. All right, so look, here's some points, teaching points. Number one, take advantage of the millennials' comfort level with teams. I mean, encourage them to join in. They're used to working in groups and teams. In contrast to those of us in the earlier generations that are like lone rangers. And by the way, millennials actually believe a team can accomplish more and better. They've experienced team success. They like it. So think about how to organize your practice in teams and drag your older members into those teams, because you're going to have a lot more efficiencies and a lot of good communication can happen. You know, they always say, you know, this, you know, watch who joins the volleyball match at the company picnic is one of the things that I had read. I mean, millennials, they gather in groups. Millennials gather in groups. They play on teams. And by the way, you can coach, mentor, and train your millennials as a team. That's why these, you know, team meetings, very important. Another thought to consider is to provide a life-work balanced workplace. You know, millennials are used to cramming their lives with multiple activities. They may play on sports teams, walk for multiple causes, spend as much time, you know, as fans at your company sports leagues and things, and spend a lot of times with family and friends. I mean, we need to think through this concept of life-work balance. It's good for all of us. Team meetings, team objectives, team activities. Try to build fun into your group. So I'm going to give you an example. I went to the virtual marketing director offices up in Michigan, and got to participate. They said, hey, by the way, we're going to have stretching. And that is a very, very millennial team. I mean, they're all of a particular age, and they're you know, mostly millennials that work in Top Practices virtual marketing director thing. So Connor, who most of you have heard on this call, he's our Google AdWords guy and account manager for some folks, leads a stretching session. And I thought, well, that's interesting, stretching, you know, whatever. So anyway, all of a sudden, at I forget the time, and I was invited, Diane and I were invited, and we got to do stretching. So everybody's standing around, and it's all stretching that's designed to help you with office problems, like carpal tunnel and things. And then, and all together, it takes, I don't know, 3 minutes, maybe 5 minutes, I don't know. But everybody's engaged, laughing together. I mean, it was such an example of people enjoying their coworkers and in a way that makes them healthier and better. Took 5 minutes. It was really, really fun to be involved in that. I can't imagine a group of boomers that would actually would think to do something like that or be so engaged or involved. And you know, your millennials are friends outside of work. I mean, they're volunteering for events. They're cleaning up things. They're working with the elderly. You know, there's a lot of things that you can think about from an outreach and marketing standpoint to engage your very interested and engaged in the community work a group of people that see this as part of what a person does. So, you know, again, a rule here is, provide a fun, employee-centered workplace. Now, you know, that can't be what it's about, but they want to enjoy their work. They want to enjoy their workplace. They want to make friends in the workplace. You should be worried if your millennial employees aren't laughing, going out with folks for lunch, planning the next company event. You know, they're really, really are engaged and involved. This idea about entitled, lazy, or whatever just doesn't make sense. You need to listen to your millennial employee. They're used to having loving parents who have scheduled their lives around their activities and events of their children's. They have ideas and opinions, and they don't take kindly to having their thoughts ignored. After all, they have had the best listening, most child-centric audience in history, which is us. They're up for a challenge, and they demand change. They don't like boring. Boring is tough for someone that's been constantly changing and scheduling and all this other stuff. They want new tasks. If you can accomplish that, I mean, what's happening next is what they want to know. Don't bore them. Don't ignore them or trivialize their confusion, or pardon me, their contribution. Now, here's the thing I want to really make sure we talked about today, Dave. They work hard, and I'm really thinking now about our millennial doctors. But they are not into the 60-hour work weeks that were defined by the baby boomers. This is a big issue that I'm hearing. Home, family, spending time with the children and families, those are priorities. And you can't lose sight of that balance. You ignore this, and you're going to get a frustrated person. So, Dave, this is a gigantic issue for Boomer and X and millennial doctors especially. I mean, it's an issue with the staff and everybody on the team, but it raises up to an entirely different level with the doctors that are working together, or in your case, the attorneys. This has got to be discussed before hiring, and certainly now if it's an issue. I mean, this whole issue of the compromise between, you know, money versus time versus efficiency, what are everybody's expectations about all of this? Because, see, my boomer doctors are like, you know, that these people are coming in and they expect to be making the same or more money than I am. I've been working at this and building and struggling for all of these years. And I hear the big thing I hear is, you know, the millennial doctors, they, you know, the whistle blows and they're out the door. And our doctors are looking for someone that is going to put the time, the effort, the intensity, intention into it. And we see that as burning the midnight oil. I mean, I think that's a big thing here now. Where's your commitment to the future if you, in fact, want to become an owner in this practice at some point? Or do you even? So, Dave, I mean, let's talk about that, because that's like the biggest nut that has to get cracked in all of this that I can see.
Yes, and I want to talk about it, but if I could just comment on two things you said, just as a warning to everybody, what Ram and I are saying today are obvious overgeneralizations.
True.
So I have two millennial women on my team. One is very introverted, and all of this team business that we're talking about, not that she's not a team player, she is, that would drive her mad and be exhausting to her and drive her out the door. The other is exactly as Rem described, a millennial. She wants to be working on a team. She wants to be doing all of these things. But understand that this is an entire generation. This is 80 million people we're talking about. So, of course, they're going to have all of the unique personal variation that you see in any human group.
Always.
The other thing is that Rem has said that millennials do, and I do find this a lot, they want to feel like their lives matter and that their work matters. And so one of the ways they translate that is to wanting to work for a company that recognizes their importance and their contribution, but also that is looking to make a broader social impact. Because you're on this call with Rem, you're by definition, I think, the type of practice that probably supports charity in the community or organizes things, but make much of that so that they understand in the hiring process that that's part of who you are. Finally, this issue that Rem is talking about is vital, and understand that they may not even be motivated to become an equity owner of a practice in the same way that you are, and they certainly may not be willing to make the sacrifices that you made because they have, as Rem says, not seen that work out so well. They want to have a better balance. So explore that and be open to the idea that there may be a place in your practice for doctors who do not want to, they just want to provide good service and have a good place to work where they could get home to be with their kids when they get home from school. But also understand that you will have to grapple with and deal realistically with the idea that unless they are able to create efficiency and do more in less time without losing quality for the patient, that there is only so much money that can be paid. So, you know, it is true that somebody who is going to work 40 hours is by definition probably going to be able to produce more than somebody that works 20 hours. But there may be somebody that can work 30 hours that gets as much done as a 40-hour person. So just be open to the idea that there is a place to consider efficiency here, and be open to the idea that the goals of these doctors you're hiring may not be the same as yours, but that doesn't mean that there's not a place for them within your practice. It may mean, though, that you need to think about equity and non-equity and how ultimately you profit and provide really good quality services to patients is a little bit different than what we've experienced in the past because the motivators aren't the same.
See, I think, okay, so first of all, I think that this has to be sorted out extremely explicitly before the doctor signs a contract and joins the practice. I don't think it is. I think very often, you know, it's all about, well, here's what you do, here's what you get paid, here's how it works. But none of these things are addressed, except in maybe a very cursory way. Dave, you were going to say?
Yeah, I'm just saying that I think we've been bad for years and sloppy as professional practice owners in doing this, whether it's a millennial or a young boomer or anybody we're hiring. Rem is making the best possible analysis of this, which is that for all of our sakes, regardless of the age of the doc that's coming on board, we should be having much more explicit conversation about this, which is that there's only X number of ways that we make money in this practice, and we either have to be more efficient or we have to be work longer and harder, and there's no right answer to you, but we should be discussing whether you even want to be on that track to be an owner or not. And don't be surprised that many of these folks will say no. They may not want that responsibility, and that may ultimately dictate who else you hire and other issues about how you're going to run your practice.
Or how you organize your practice and whether or not you would bring in potentially physician extenders that would give you, you know, the ability to build and grow the practice without having a doctor. I mean, the traditional plan is come here, and if you work hard and things go well, then we'll talk about you having ownership in this. I mean, that's about about as good as it goes for most folks, without any real clear understanding. There's so much misunderstanding on this point. And I just think you have to be clear. If you're bringing someone in because you're at a stage in your career where you are looking for a future partner and someone that you can work with to actually have equity and buy you out, that has to be really explicit and clear up front, because you may be hiring someone that really never ever thought about it and doesn't hold that as a very strong value. They might be more interested in having just a great job and skiing as much as they possibly can, or being or doing, you know, parenting, whatever it is they're planning on doing. The way they see things is different than you. But what happens, Dave, is then they say, well, you know, typical millennial, you know, doesn't want to work hard, wants to be paid a fortune, and for not and working.
And if we haven't had that conversation, that's on us, really, not them, because they probably had clarity about it, and they made assumptions just like we did, but we're the practice owner that's hiring them. So it's incumbent upon us to have more clarity in the hiring process.
So, Dave, now somebody's listening right now and they're saying, okay, that would have been great 3 years ago when I hired this doctor, but I have all those frustrations right now. What should I do now?
Yeah, and so let's start with this, that was our mistake. We got to own that rather than that doctor, because we weren't explicit about this. And so I think that the interaction that has to follow and the conversations that have to follow are going to be different if we accept responsibility for that rather than trying to shift it to them. So that's step one. Step two is, well, we didn't have the conversation when we should have, and we're owning it, but we've got to have it now. We've got to go back and talk through that. Do you want to be an equity doc in this practice? Here are the traditional ways that we've got to that. Do you have any alternatives? Or if you don't want to, then maybe we've got to hire some sort of adjunct role, because I'm going to start phasing into retirement. You're going to be seeing more patients, and maybe we have to have another part-time doc, but an administrator, because you don't want to be an equity owner in this, fine. But if we just keep putting that conversation off because it's hard, we blame the other person for something that we created by not getting into it, because after all, practice, then that's not going to be helpful. So I think you still have those conversations today, because they just get harder, not any better.
Well, I agree with that. And you know, I think you have to sit back and you have to, again, I really think you've got to sort through what you see as a quality job. I mean, and so, you know, you got a doc that does great job, does everything right, have, you know, and charts are done. Saw the number of patients they were supposed to see today, and they're just boom out the door. Is that going to keep bugging you, or do you look at yourself and say, I've got a good doctor there providing high quality care, as a good producer for the practice? I'm good with that. Even though, you know, you're what we believe is you know, the boomers were raised to say, you know, you go in and you demonstrate your enthusiasm by, you know, these 60-hour work weeks and by putting all that time in and doing all that stuff. To us, that's how you show that you care. And yet, again, like I said, for the millennial doctor who said, you know, yeah, my dad did that for X number of years, and they just threw him out to pasture. You know, what would be the motivation for me to say, boy, that sounds like a great plan. Let me go make the same mistake again. I mean, that's what we're kind of dealing, not kind of, that is what we are dealing with. And so I do think that clear discussions about expectations and a willingness on your part to take that doctor as they are. In other words, okay, you know, we've talked this all through, and if there's a plan for equity, that means you are putting in time. You're doing these following extra things and all of these things that matter. I mean, that's how you get to, if you really want to be an owner, to own a practice along with me, there is a plan, but it is different than what you're talking about. It's going to take a bigger investment, not just of finances, but of your time. I mean, if that's the way that you truly see it. And so they need to know that. And you have to be willing to say that person may well just, you know, may just network themselves right out the door, which they often do. And are you comfortable with that? Are you going and looking then for the person that's going to fit your model? Or do you need to fix the way you look at these younger doctors? And everything that we said about millennials applies to these younger doctors, and how they they observe their work and how they what they value, are you willing to make some? Are you willing to grow? And because you know you're not going to get a new. There's not going to be a new crop of a new generation. The next generation is not even you know they're in school. And so this is it. This is the population that you have. Are you going to understand them better and then try to use what you can to make that to make this a lot more successful? I think that's sort of where we'll leave it today. Does anybody want to unmute their line, star six, ask a question? We've gone over, but there's a lot to cover, and there's a lot to cover for the next time too, Dave, so we'll be busy. Anybody have anything to ask about today or want to jump in? You can save it till next time. We can have a extended discussion because I think we'll be able to do that. All right. Well, listen, Dave, thanks, buddy. Interesting stuff, complicated stuff, but the thing that you need to remember is that you can't sit this one out. 80 million people, it is our workforce, and they are fabulous, really, really great people. They just were raised and see the world differently than we do, and there's nothing wrong with that. They are going to change things dramatically. That's the question is, what will they do once they have our roles? Will they in fact rework, you know, life? And they could make things wonderful if they were good at it. Cause you know, we've not been the best at it. So any final thoughts today, Dave?
No, I just would like to say, Rem, that as I went through this and preparing, and hopefully we gave everybody the same experience, there were at least two or three things that I jotted down going from theory to practice that I want to do a better job of. I think we're doing a better job of this. So this one for me had lots of actionable points to it. And maybe on the next one, we can have some liberal QA, but we can also, you know, just kind of review some action items that you and I are either taking and or other things that we mentioned today and in the next one, where these should be on your to-do list or at least on your to think about and schedule some time to do. You can't listen to this call and not have one or two things you want to be doing
differently. No, it's big. And I would also ask you to jump in on that. I know the biggest frustration for both the millennial doctor and the boomer Gen X doctor is this you know relationship. I think the other members of the team, the stakes are high. They're just not quite this high. And, because we're talking about equity, you know, and I only know of, a couple ways to get equity. One's to risk it, one's to buy it. And, so it's interesting. So really send me and Dave, you know, just send me and I'll get it to Dave. Questions ahead of time for this, we'll solicit them because I'd like to kind of get into it even more. Yeah, and Dave, I've got a bunch of like actionable things for the next call that struck me. There's even more coming, and there's some things that struck me as like, boy, I wonder if I'm frustrating the millennials that I'm working with because I'm forcing them to accommodate my boomer tendencies. In some cases, I think that's the case. So, I mean, I've got some things I'm working on too with this. It's important. All right, my friend, we're over. I'll talk to you next time. Thanks so much, Dave. I really appreciate it. It's great. Bye-bye, buddy.
Honored to be here.